two, three, testing.
Unless
this is a Senate Committee on Judiciary meeting in Senate Room 343 on May the 30th, 1989 at 5:30 p.m. Informational meeting on 8:58. Work session 977. House Bill 2127, House Bill 2275, 2277, 2278, 2279, 2280, 2281, 2421, 2455, 2465, 2470, 2769, 3195, and a carryover on work session of HB 2668. Public hearing on House Bill 2518, public hearing and possible work session on the following: HJR 2, HB 2513, HB 2561, 3004, 3200, 3365. 1, 2, 3, testing.
Done ahead of time because I know how fast we're going to move here. Want you to know that we're missing a softball practice. But no sacrifice is too great.
Okay. We have Representative Calori here.
We're going to have to take Calori.
Okay, I'm going to check.
Actually, some of these are Catherine's, anyway. So you'll keep notes, Catherine, along the way.
Okay.
Representative Calori, would you like to come up here? Let's take House Bill 3365 first, which is simpler and has Ms. Cedarly set.
Yes.
Would you like to join me?
And that one is a Catherine bill, but that's all right. She can work from over there.
Right.
House Bill 3365 was on our list once before, and we suggested that they come back, and she was kind enough to do that. And Representative Calori.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, I am Ted Calori, State Representative from Washington County. I have Emily Cedarleaf with me. As you mentioned, this bill is rather simple in concept, and it revolves around the fact that many of the larger properties in this state are managed by property managers. The law relating to giving notification on pending actions does not really particularly take account of that and talks about notifying the owners of properties, and this bill is designed to allow a practicality of informing property managers in addition to the property owners. It was carried on the House floor and received 58 votes yea and no noes. And I'll ask Emily to give some more about it if there is a need to do that.
Great. Emily Cedarly, representing the Multifamily Housing Council. 50% of rental property in the state of Oregon is under the management of property managers. And as Mr. Calori advised you, those people are not in the cycle of information when legal notices are filed. This bill will solve the problem of notifying us, especially under the drug house ordinances that are in either House Bill 3015 or in the city of Salem and Portland. So we ask your support for the bill.
Are there questions? I have one. I guess it's to Representative Calori. Are we actually putting one more sort of form into the statute here, or is there an existing form that goes into the statute?
I believe that it's an existing form, but is it changed?
as far as I'm concerned, it's a new form. There was no mechanism to notify rental property owners before, and this would be a permissive that the rental property manager could file and be picked up under the title report, so that when the city notifies of a manufacturing or drug delivery site, that that property manager as well as the owner will be notified.
I understand the concept, and I fully agree with the concept. My only concern is we have a little policy that says, to the extent possible, we don't sort of replicate exact forms in the ORS statute because they kind of get long and unwieldy, and I'm questioning whether you need a brand new form or whether it follows on to an existing form. And I guess that's my only question. I think we need to do it. It's a question of whether you need, since it's not a very complicated form, or, you know, it seems like we could prescribe by sentence that there be
to include
the name, the address, then the property affected, the date, and the license number. Which would take. Do you mind if we work on that a little bit and get it done without the inclusion of a form, since it's a bit of a form and style that we try to keep?
No, I think that sounds fine, and I think it was attempted to be helpful here and have it pre-thought, but I think you're right, and that's fine.
Okay. Sure. Just reading this really for the first time, I noticed one thing that raises a question. There doesn't seem to be any time limit on this request, so that once it's recorded, it presumably would go on forever, which would be impractical after a while. I wonder if it would be appropriate to put on some period of time when you have to renew your request so that it will automatically sunset, because property managers turn over and property turns over.
Well, plus the pending action.
Senator Cohen, Senator Shoemaker, this form was designed so that the property manager is held, can be held legally responsible for any actions that are pending on that property. So it would be a matter that they would file the notice when they want the notice, and they would file a termination of that notice when they no longer manage the property.
There's no
and
mandate.
It would be up to them.
But if they don't do that, and most of them won't, or many of them won't, because they wouldn't have any incentive to, they have no further interest in it, they just move on to other things, then you have in the records this official request that they be notified forever of any pending action, claim, lien, or proceeding relating to the parcel. Now you've put a burden on the clerk to send this notice out to this party who's off, you know, has nothing to, whatever to do with the property anymore. So maybe if we had some kind of a 5-year termination of it or something like that, would that?
I think you could do that. On the other hand, the chances are that that same property will be managed by another property manager. I mean, not necessarily, but it's possible. Right. If it's a large complex, it's very likely that that might be the case.
Right.
So then when it gets sent out and gets sent to Amberley Cedarleaf, manager for such and such a property, I would think that there would be a pretty good chance that that would be passed on to the successor. At least that way the property manager of that property would be notified, even if it's a different individual. But your suggestion, I think, you know, is not without.
If you don't mind, we'll work on it a little and try to see if we can get some at least requirement to terminate or to supplant with a different, that the property owner has to provide a new.
When the change is
right. Made. So put the termination onto the property owner, that if they want it sent to a new manager's name or whatever, that be done. I think probably we could add, Catherine, a little piece onto that.
Senator Kona, the one thing I will remind you that this is relating to the real estate division licensees, so that they could pick it up in administrative rule also to put that in, that you start the process and you stop the process when you don't manage the property. Because there is a legal liability for those notices, that if I get a notice that says you got 10 days to start eviction against a tenant and I've not taken that action, I have assumed some liability because I haven't filed the termination of the notice.
Good. We'll check it out. Appreciate your comments, and I think the concept is a good one.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, Emily. Let's move on then, Representative Kalari, to House Bill 2518.
Thank you. I'd like to have a different person join me if I could. It's you. Ted Kalari, State Representative from Washington County, and I have coming up to join me Gary Wilhelms. This bill originated and was at the request of U.S. West Communications. Go ahead. I think maybe it would be appropriate in that in this case to ask him to testify as to the overall need for this bill, and then I will join in and have some amendments even since the time it left the House that would make me just a little bit more comfortable, and I'd like to address those.
Okay. For the record, my name is Gary Wilhelms. I'm Director of Legislative Affairs for U.S. West Communications in Oregon, and I don't plan to take much of your time. But House Bill 2518 is a relatively simple bill. The existing computer crime statute, ORS 164.377, was passed in the 1985 session. It's a good start, but needs just a little bit of fine-tuning. Our security department contacted us during the interim and asked if there wasn't something that could be done to strengthen the law by stiffening the penalties for computer hacking. It seems that phone companies are prime targets of hackers. Examples might be our entire database, which includes names, addresses, phone numbers, including non-published phone numbers, credit information, long-distance numbers called, and lots of other proprietary information that most of us would not want others to have access to. It is true that if the hacker accessed our billing system and in some way experienced monetary gain as a result, the hacker would be guilty of a felony under other statutes if the monetary gain was significant enough, and that is $500 or more. However, if the hacker accesses our database and obtains proprietary or confidential information, such as non-published numbers or addresses, and the example I had given to me was of drug enforcement officers, for example, or in some other way manipulates credit or other information without actually stealing anything with a fixed value, the hacker would be guilty simply of a misdemeanor. We believe that accessing and or manipulating our database is much more significant than stealing $500 worth of services or credit. Thus, we believe it appropriate to make this type of computer crime a Class C felony also. The original bill was amended in the House to ensure that simple mischief would not be brought under a felony statute. This type of hacking would be unaffected by this bill. And we agree with Representative Kalluri that the definition of data could be improved, although we are not concerned over the language contained in the bill as passed by the House. And I have listed some language there for your consideration if you wish to amend the definition of data. A final thought, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Under existing law, it appears that if I take my hammer and walk into your office and bash your IBM PC or whatever other computer you have, I am guilty of a Class C felony. However, if I take my personal computer at home and gain access to and manipulate any of the many State of Oregon databases, including your own, I am guilty only of a Class A misdemeanor. And I think you will agree that the potential for harm is at least as great in the latter example. And I hope you will act favorably on House Bill 2518, a simple but good bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Yes.
Senator Hill.
What's the extent of the problem?
Well, let me, if you might, let me read you an example of what came out of our security folks. Won't take just a second. In May of 1987, a computer hacker entered one of our systems and gained access to proprietary information, including non-published numbers and addresses and telephone facilities of several people he did not care for. He had the ability to manipulate our system and disconnect their service, for example. One of his plans was to manipulate our system to gain access to an automatic teller machine, or an ATM line, and then transfer funds to his own account. Essentially, he would have robbed a bank, and there would have been no way to prove who did it. We are presently investigating a case where one of our customers claims an acquaintance has entered our system and gained access to his toll records, thus finding out who he's calling to, when, and for how long. All of the above information is proprietary by law, but it isn't a felony to get it unless it is sold. Just think what a criminal could do with the non-published numbers of judges, police officers, federal drug agents, and so on. And as long as the criminal didn't sell the information, under Oregon law, it's not a serious crime. So in response, Senator Hill, I would say that we have examples. These would be two of them, but it's not widespread. We're trying to get ourselves in the position where we can more adequately deal with the problem that we think is going to do nothing but get worse.
Please, Senator Hill.
Do you have much trouble getting the authorities to prosecute these, or?
Senator, I can't give you a good answer to that. I don't believe we've had any trouble. I don't believe we've been involved in that many where prosecution has actually occurred.
I wonder if I, Senator Hill, I have in my possession here a copy of the article or two out of the NCSL magazine, which talks about this whole area of legislation. It talks initially about the gee whiz kind of crimes that have been committed, and I have some highlighted here. $20 million taken from a branch of the Wells Fargo Bank. $260,000 taken from a broker in San Francisco, and you know the list goes on and on. It's the kind of thing that you read in Parade magazine. You know, you could, there's no end to the amount of exposure there is in terms of in the case of financial institutions, and that's why I kind of wanted to add to the fact that this is not just a telephone company bill. You know, this is a general computer kind of a bill, and there are large exposures both in terms of the amount of money that can be involved, but in addition to that, I think most of the companies in this state and others too would tell you that the investment that they have in computer software is one of the largest investments that they have, numbering up in the millions of dollars. And so it has to do, generally speaking, with not only just having access to data and files, but also having to do with programming. And, you know, the viruses that you talk about where someone gets in and gets something into a computer program, which then in turn has an effect on the programming for the way they do their business. So it's that kind of gravity. It can be millions and billions of dollars. I might also say, since I brought that subject up, that there are a significant number of other states that have passed similar type of legislation, and when I get to talking about the amendments I have, I will tell you that I have borrowed from some other states.
Madam Chair, similar penalties? Similar penalties in terms of gravity?
Yes.
Perhaps, not being a computer whiz, I'm the only one that has this difficulty, but I was having a little bit of trouble distinguishing between the situations where you would have a felony and a misdemeanor, and that's specifically because in the misdemeanor portion, it defines access. Well, one of the components of access is retrieving data. Can you distinguish that from committing theft of proprietary information? I just don't see what the distinction is, and that's what I'm asking you.
I'm not sure that I follow your question. Could you make reference to?
On line 6 of the bill, it says to access, one of the things that it means is retrieve data. Now, as I understand it, in Section 4, accessing is a misdemeanor. Okay? And then the felony crime, with the new definition of proprietary information, covers theft of proprietary information, and it seems to me that those are, if not the same, real similar. And can you tell me what?
Just simple. I believe the distinction is that simple access of information would be a misdemeanor. Accessing proprietary information would be a Class C felony. And the reason that it was, as a matter of fact, that I believe was an amendment that was made in the House of Representatives and differs from what we originally proposed. And the reason was that the way we had it worded in the beginning was that the Class C felony would have applied in a case of simple mischief where, for example, some students get very good at manipulating information on computers and they will play tricks on each other and access each other's information. Under the language that we had proposed, that simple mischief type of access would have been a Class C felony. And I don't believe that anybody was intending for that to be the case.
I understand your intent. I guess I'm just not clear on how retrieving data is different from, perhaps I'm the only one that doesn't understand it. I don't know.
I'm not sure if I can help very much either. I remember precisely the discussion that took place, and I remember it was Representative Mannix who helped us to sort out the difference between subsection 2 and 3 and subsection 4, and it had to do with 4 and the example that was used was someone borrowing, taking a PC or even a calculator or something like that and making use of it, as opposed to having access of the kind that we are talking about here, where you actually get in and get into the data that's stored in there and the major mainframe type programming. And that, again, but I'm not sure that I've explained that very well either. I do know that there was an attempt to distinguish the two different types.
Well, maybe we have to check with them. We just need to further clarify, Jack, and look at the records and talk to Mannix or whoever made that distinguishing factor to see how, and maybe we ought to get tapped into your lawyers at some point to see what we can.
We can sure do that.
Senator Hill.
Have you run this by any of the DAs? In terms of, I mean, if they're the ones who are going to have to prosecute these cases.
Yeah.
Has that been?
They were present. There were some.
There was someone from Multnomah County DA's office at the time that this bill was worked in.
I believe Representative Bauman asked the question.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Go back and replow that record.
Any other questions?
Madam Chairman, if
yes,
I could, I just I want to make clear that you do have before you, I hope, the amendment, which, for the most part,
I think it's. Is it in the files, Catherine? Have we passed it out yet? The 2518 amendments, or Jack?
No, well, this is mine.
Jack,
I don't believe I have any amendments. Are you referring to the amendment that's in Mr. Wilhelm's testimony?
No.
No.
This is a Legislative Council amendment.
Well, I have some others here.
Yeah. I don't see any in our file.
I'm sorry, I don't believe I've seen them.
Okay, I thought you did. Now that it's taken from me. Let me describe for you. I was a little uncomfortable with the definition on the engrossed bill, line 22 of data. And so I did two or three other things since the time it left the House, and that was I checked with a group that are an association of computer consultants in the Portland metropolitan area, and asked them to take a look at it and their opinion come up with a little bit more comprehensive and a little bit more modern, frankly, definition of data. In addition to that, I think Mr. Wilhelms went to his company and particularly to the data processing people, whereas before I think he had dealt with the security people and the attorneys and asked them also. And then in addition to that, we got copies of the statutes in four other states and looked at what they use. And the amendment that will be given to you was an attempt to take what I felt was the best of all of those and to, frankly, build on the statute as it appears in those other states. And it was interesting to see, because what you can see very clearly is that this legislation started in one state, and they came up with one definition. And then you can just pretty well tell which state it went to next and which one the next and which one the next, because each one added a little bit more. And they were pretty much all the same wording, except they just continued to add to it. And so I would like to suggest to you that this definition of data be included. The first, if you look on line 5, if you now have it, the two or three sentences starting on line 5 and up to about line 8 are the basically the ones that have been borrowed from other states that have similar legislation. And then in addition to that, the line that sentence rather that runs from on line 8, data include but not limited to, that is kind of our local addition. And I think that it stands a better test of currency, if you will, because it includes a little bit better description of images and stored voice, and talks about having it, the data can be either computer or human readable. And I guess in my assessment, that is just a little bit more complete and a little bit more descriptive than what was either in the original bill or in as it was passed through the House. So it seemed to me that that would be just a little bit more improvement. And I don't know whether it would ever have any bearing that having that better definition would help any, but it just seemed to me that it would, and I felt a little that it professionally it just seemed to be a little bit better description.
Okay, are there other comments? Senator Schumacher.
I have a question, not about the definition of data. I think I agree, Ted, that probably is quite an improvement. But as I've just been pondering, proprietary information has the implication that it is proprietary in that it's owned by the person who has the computer. And yet the definition doesn't have in it any aspect of ownership. It's merely a description of really any information. And so it could, or it could be information that's just that's common knowledge, I guess. And is it your intent that it be a Class C felony to extract common knowledge from a computer, regardless of who owns the knowledge or whether anyone does, because it's defined as proprietary without there being a sense of ownership of that information?
Well, Senator, maybe, I guess, in our industry, proprietary information has a definite meaning, and it certainly doesn't mean common knowledge. Now maybe that's telephonese. I wouldn't debate that with you, but proprietary information is, in our business, is generally that information which is, although not secret, is kept, is the access to that information is closed, and only people with a need to know can gain access to that information.
And I've worked on license agreements, know-how agreements, and that sort of thing, and we include the concept of proprietary information in there, and it has exactly the same meaning that you just described. My concern is that this definition does not pick up that concept.
Well, if we need to work on that, we will do that also.
Yeah, well, I think you can check it by Senator Shoemaker. I do think, though, in one quick, I'd like to respond and put my two cents in with this sort of version, is that I don't want to limit it to just proprietary information that might be the telephone companies. I think there are some personal information which happens to be proprietary for other folks who not necessarily are owned by the telephone company. So I don't want, whatever we come up with here, I'd like to make sure that we protect a consumer or customer whose information also, who offers that information or who would otherwise be limited to access, closed to access. So I just want to put that on the table for whatever discussions we move into.
I think we're all driving at the same thing. Sure we are.
Can you show me where the common usage kind of thing fit implied
when you say proprietary information, which is in your definition, that's your phrase of art,
right,
includes any scientific, technical, or commercial information. And then it goes on to including any, and it sort of then breaks it down a bit. But it has no concept of it in there of information that was developed by.
I see. Or for the unique to this organization or something like that.
Yeah.
I see, okay.
The words intellectual property are also kicked around in the computer circles. I don't know if that's something that we might build into this definition that would that would clarify it.
Right.
Well, we can discuss that.
Okay, well, I guess I'd send you off to say, be in touch with Senator Schumaker and get your lawyers involved, if you would, Gary, and see if we can further refine some of these definitions and work to get the bill. Senator Hill?
Just a quick question. Now, in most states now, have this type of statute, and in most states, this is a felony.
Well, I'd have to go. I don't want to give you some kind of a blanket. I'd have to go back and take a look for sure. We have all I was working from, very honest. Well, let's see, I worked from the mention of the various states in this NCSL article, and then by having my staff call and ask someone to read it. But I'd rather give you a little bit more complete report on that before I tell you something that might be misleading.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. And you'll note that Senator Hill has those concerns about wanting to know about felony issues here. Anything else with respect to 2518? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Beth Bridges, excuse me, is here from the City of Eugene.
Parental contact, love, support, nurturing, visitation. And so without more, again, we can terminate parental rights. What we'd like to do is change the time period on Section 4 from 1 year to 6 months where they failed or neglected without reasonable or lawful cause to provide for their care. That's only at a point where we can file a termination petition. It takes an average of 15 months on an appeal for a case, and it usually takes us between 3 months to 6 months to even get into court. So again, this would just be the initial threshold for us to file the termination petition. Under Section 5, again, it's the same type of section, failure to provide. They've either abandoned the child or they've left the child under circumstances so that they cannot find the parent or parents. Basically, we call that desertion. Abandonment is the type of case that you recently learned about over in Eastern Oregon where they put the baby in the box out in the snow in the parking lot and nobody knows where the parents are. Desertion is basically potentially a mother or father who leaves the child with a neighbor or a grandparent for a day or two saying, I'll be back on Monday, and never shows up, and through diligent efforts, we cannot find them. Instead of having, and again, we do have to do diligent search in trying to find these parents. Instead of having to wait for 6 months in these cases, we would like to limit that to 3 months. Section 3 deals with juvenile court jurisdiction. Any questions on the failure to provide section?
No.
Thank
you.
Section 3 deals, the last part deals with juvenile court jurisdiction, and basically that would amend the basis for jurisdiction of these children. And subsection E would change so that a parent or another person having custody of the person, if they've been convicted of a crime involving abuse or neglect of a child, or they're married to a person who has been convicted of a crime of abuse or neglect or living with a person, that could trigger juvenile court jurisdiction. Now again, that does not in fact mean that CSD would file a petition, that they would go out and take the child into care, or that the court would take jurisdiction, but it would allow CSD to file a petition and the court to take jurisdiction on that basis. Again, we have, unfortunately, incidences where we've had individuals who have murdered children, who have raped and sodomized children. They've done their time in jail. They come out. They hook up with another woman who has young children. They abuse those children. They go back to jail. They get out. They come out. They hook up with another woman with young children. And again, those kids are at risk. Oftentimes, we will inform the mother that she should stay away from this individual, that those kids are at risk. They don't always take our advice, and therefore it repeats. Only in those cases where there is a risk to those children would CSD be interested in filing something in court And again, that's just original jurisdiction where the court, not termination of parental rights, but original jurisdiction where the court would first become involved with the family.
Madam Chair.
Chair Shoemaker.
The jurisdiction of the juvenile court is over the child, though, is it not?
Correct.
It's not over the parents.
It's not over the parents. Again, the maximum that you could do, although, again, not at original jurisdiction, mm-hmm. but the maximum you could do would be ultimately termination of parental rights. There's really nothing you could do to the parents. Well,
let me just raise a technical question. In the strict language of the statute, it looks as if the juvenile court would have jurisdiction over the parents if there is some action brought against them because of neglect or whatever, since that would be any case involving the child, even though it's a case against the parents. I'm sure that's not what's intended, but you might want to focus on that a little bit and see if that should be fixed.
On line 23 and 24, is that what you're...
Well, that line 23 coupled with the new language on lines 34 and 35, it sounds as if it could include jurisdiction over the parent because it is a case involving the child. But even, I'm just wondering if you might want to, in line 23, and I think this might be an improvement in the statute generally.
Mm-hmm.
The juvenile court has exclusive jurisdiction over a person who is under 18 years of age and then have that series.
Yeah, because that is actually the intent. There's no intent to have any jurisdiction over the parents, and there's nothing they can do. It's just the jurisdiction over the child. Yeah. So that certainly would help clarify it.
Okay, any other questions? Yeah. Debbie, how do you see line 43 and 44 interacting with the neglect of a child on line 34?
On page, I'm sorry.
Page 3.
Okay.
Reading E, either the person or parents or any other person having custody has been convicted of a crime involving abuse or neglect of a child, coupled with a reading of... line 43, the court shall have jurisdiction even though the child is receiving adequate care from the person having physical custody of the child.
I don't think they're inconsistent. Basically, it says that if a parent's been convicted, say, of abusing or neglecting one child, they could take jurisdiction over another child, say a sibling. Or if a parent's living with somebody who was convicted, living with a new boyfriend who was convicted of killing another child.
Yeah, but I'm reading it specifically for neglect. It says abuse or neglect. And if you have somebody who's been convicted of neglect, but they're living with someone who is taking adequate physical care of the child,
right.
Would you see that as a reason for intervention?
Yes, basically neglect could also lead to the death of a child. You know, they're not watching them, they're sleeping, and they go out into the intersection of the road and they get killed. Number two, the part two says that you can have jurisdiction even though the person having physical custody, even though the mother is doing an adequate job, the fact that she's living with this individual who is a risk of her child because they're not doing an adequate job. And I think you'd have to say, again, this mother would be leaving her child with this person who has neglected a kid to a point where he was convicted of a crime.
Why do you need the word neglect in there at all? Up on line 35, what is it?
Well, only
I guess I'd want a whole bunch of that.
Yeah, only because there are criminal neglect statutes that can... that they can be convicted of that lead to the death or serious injury of a child or risk to a child, and that's why that was included.
Could you provide a listing of those for us, please, so we know what
sure.
that is? Into the law.
Yes, sir.
Sir, no.
Quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. In the situations where, for example, when there has been abandonment or desertion, do in parental rights are terminated, do you automatically zero priority list you go down as far as grandparents and that kind of thing? I mean, for example, in the case of desertion, would you try to find the grandparents or someone who was related to that individual? Is that the procedure?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill. Yes, we do give...
You need to get your name on the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Karen Pearson from Children's Services Division. Our policy, and it's established by administrative rule, is that we do give preference to relatives who are interested in caring for the child, and we consider that at the point of initially placing a child, as well as when we're looking at an adoption plan, we consider the relatives as well as the caretaker of the child and give some preference to both.
That's for abandonment and desertion as well?
Yes. If we know who they are, as Debbie pointed out, in some instances we have had a few children we really didn't know who they were, but those are rare.
So you're able to determine that within, from going from 6 down to 3 months, does that impede your being able to take the time to find out if they're grandparents or someone else?
We really haven't had any problem with that. Usually abandonment cases are well publicized, and they come up maybe once a year, and they're all over the place. If there's any way of identifying relatives, they usually come forward.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much. Let's take Tammy Mowdy, who is the last person to sign up from Albany, Oregon, and then we're going to move to the House Bill 3004 next. Representative Dix is here, but let's take you first, Tani. Is it Tani?
Tammy. Well, Madam Chairman, Jenny, I am Tani Mowdy. I've been a foster parent for 8.5 years. I'm past president of Linn County Foster Parent Association. I've had 37 children over the last 8.5 years, and out of those 37, 10 of them have been through termination of parental rights or relinquishment, so they've went on to be adopted. In fact, I'm in the process of, my husband and I are in the process of adopting two of them right now. And we have, only two of those adoptions didn't work. And this bill, I'm really scared being here, and I'm not scared talking to you, and I'm not scared about all the people around me, but I'm just scared that I won't pick the right words to let you know how important this bill is. We've had children in our home for 4 years. Before the case was finally resolved and a family was picked for him. That's a long time in a little girl's life. We have kids that are in care, and they come in and they say, where am I going to spend my next birthday? I just had my birthday. Can I have my birthday here again? That's real hard to hear from an 8-year-old child. We have 3 adoptions that have been finalized in our county in the last 6 months or so, and every one of those children were placed at birth or by the time they were 3 or 4 months old. One of the adoption papers hasn't been signed yet, and the child is 3.5 years old. That is the only, that's their whole life that they've been in care, and the biggest part of it has been because of the court system and all the time it takes and all the game playing that goes on. And it just simply has to be shortened some way. We have kids that that parents have killed one child. They went to jail, and mom's waiting for daddy to get out so she can live with him again and take these children back out of care and live with him, and has no intention. Says, I am not going to go to mental health. I'm not going to go anyplace. I'm going to raise my child, and we're going to be a family, knowing that he's already killed one of her children. This kind of stuff just can't go on. They need some way that they can file for termination on these very extreme cases where they can tell they have psychologicals and they have all the evidence they need, but the law doesn't say that they can go ahead and file. And we really, really need this law. We've this written in. When a person rapes a child, and we have kids at 3 or 4 years old that are being raped, and then they're saying, oh, you can't terminate on them. You got to give them a chance. We're having all the drug babies and kids that are being placed in care. Right now in the Portland area, there's 200 or 300 children waiting to go on the permanent planning things so they can finally get to the termination thing, because there isn't enough money for caseworkers. And then we're going to hold those kids up longer because we still have to work with parents and parents that don't ever come. And I'm not talking about the parents that really want to parent their kids. We have lots of families that come by to see us that bring their kids back that say, hey, you know, I remember living here and we had a good time, and can you give my mom this recipe? And that's great, and we want to help those people. But when it's not going to work, and when the kids are going to be at risk, and there's a real big risk that they're going to be killed, we can't be sending them back home to them.
Thank you. Other questions? Oh, sorry. Thank you very much. I know that there are foster care families in my district who feel the same way, and I've heard from them. Thank you for coming. Okay, let's move to House Bill 3004. Representative Dix is here, and Helen Jane Williams is here. Thanks for waiting. I apologize.
No, Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to do this real quickly and then move on down to another committee that I have. I appreciate that very much. For the record, I'm David Dix, State Representative District 41 from Eugene. With me is Helen Jane Williams from Eugene, representing the Older Women's League and the Older Women's Coalition. House Bill 3004 was introduced at the request of the Older Women's Coalition and the Older Women's League. The bill is a housekeeping bill that simply adds one sentence to the domestic relations law in ORS Chapter 107, Section 135 that was passed last session. House Bill 3004 adds, in quote, in any subsequent motion for modification, the court shall deny the motion if the sole basis of the motion for modification is the termination of voluntary retirement, is the termination of voluntary taken retirement benefits and the obligor previously has been found not to have acted in good faith. This addition makes sure a person who is no longer receiving regular retirement checks because they voluntarily retired early and was previously found not to have acted in good faith cannot come back to the court claiming they are unable to pay support. This provision should have been in the original bill that Senator Springer and some other members in the House worked on last session, House Bill 3030. My apologies to the committee for coming to you with the slight change in this particular bill. Its sole purpose is to protect individuals who need the support to live on. And once again, thank you for taking the time and allowing me to testify in front of other folks, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Simple bill.
Thanks. Representative Dix, other questions? Helen Jane.
Well, I don't have much to add to that, except that it caps a possible loophole which was meant to be on the last bill, so that, in other words, if they started to voluntarily take this at the time the court found them to be in bad faith, and this is part of the bad faith money action, they shouldn't be able to come into court again on another change of circumstance and suddenly claim that the money is now ended or terminated. But it makes it clear here that they can come in on other reasons. For example, if they become ill or something that has nothing to do with the money situation originally that they were found to be in bad, not in good faith over, they still can come back to court. So it doesn't, you know, keep a person from ever coming back to court.
Are there questions?
Just wondering if it could ever operate in a way that you don't intend it to. Familiar enough with the field. Is there any possibility that in this sentence, termination of voluntarily taken retirement benefits?
Senator Shoemaker, if somebody takes voluntary retirement benefits, that's a decision they've made, and they do so with the hope that those retirement benefits are going to run out before their support is due. That's the situation we're trying to address. And in working through 3030 last session, Senator Springer worked on that as well as Representative Bunn. And Representative Bunn, I think, does a lot of that work and made sure that we tried to take in those considerations and also address this on the floor. We went through some floor debate to make sure that it was every situation was covered and that it wouldn't be a situation arise where it went back on us.
So what happens if you terminate the voluntarily taken retirement benefits? So that means then you don't take them after all. Is that what that would mean?
No.
What does it mean?
If you take voluntary retirement benefits with the purpose that by taking them early, as I understand it, they're going to run out before the support runs out, before the court-ordered support runs out, and you've done that so that you can go to court and modify your order and say, well, my retirement's run out, so lower my support payments.
Okay, got that. But now when you come back then a second time, you've already gone through that, now you come back in a subsequent motion for modification, and you termination of voluntarily taken retirement benefits. Okay. So now they've run out. That's the termination that you mean. You don't mean termination in the sense of unretiring or something.
Right. Right, and this is only cases where bad faith has already been found. That's by the court.
Any other questions? Senator Hill, want to move the bill?
Yep. Yes, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 3004 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
This is scheduled for a hearing and possible work session. Senator Hill has moved House Bill 3004 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please. Pat.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Motion carried. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much,
ma'am. Okay. Jack is back. We have one, two, three bills I get that are Jack's, and then we'll tease him for the rest of the evening. Let's take up 977.
Senate Bill 977, as you'll recall, is the juvenile diversion bill having to do with denial of driving privileges for children between the ages of 13. It's at the request of Citizens for a Drug Free Oregon. There are some amendments I'll hand out to you. What I'm passing out is sort of a three-part package. There's new amendments from the sponsor of the bill. There is a fiscal impact statement, and there are also in the bill there are some blanks you'll find for insertion of fee costs and that type of thing. There's also a sheet that I've typed up of the dollar figures they want inserted in the blanks that I've gotten from Senator Phillips' office. The amendments, there's also an explanatory note from Joan Robinson. What the amendment essentially does is make it so that if a child finishes the 90-day mandatory denial of driving privileges period and then gets into diversion and successfully completes it, then the judge after that 90-day period must give them their driving privileges back.
Okay. You want to go through the blanks, I guess?
Yes, the blanks are found on page 3 of the bill. The first and probably most noteworthy blank is the actual cost of the diversion program itself. The figures I've been supplied with from Senator Phillips' office are the figures that track with the adult DUII diversion statute. So the fee is $282, and then as you can see, the distribution of that amount is $70 to the agency providing the diagnostic assessment, $12 to the Department of Revenue and to the police standards and training account, $100 to mental health, and $100 to be dispersed pursuant to another statute. Then finally, the fiscal sheet, you'll see it states a general fund need of $821. I've discussed that with Kay Hutchison just prior to the hearing. Given the figures that we're plugging in, her estimate is about $150,000 less than that.
Less than the 800?
Yes.
I guess the only thing I would, is that the general sort of payment schedule that people will, that we're likely to expect? And I guess I'm curious to know whether we're going to get that much. We've assumed that the payments are going to be similar to the adults, and I'm wondering whether we're going to retrieve that much money, but I guess we just have to fill the information we have to go on.
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Rockland.
I remember the subject having come up earlier, but I don't remember the rationale of it. Not younger than 13 years of age, especially when we're talking about $282. I imagine there are 13-year-olds driving around under the influence of one thing or another, but am I missing something? I didn't think you could drive unless you had some farm exclusion or something like
not
that.
Legally, no.
I mean, we're just going after, am I incorrect in that assumption?
I don't know, Rosanna, you wanna come and make that
I do, I
comment
would like
about
a clarification
the 13-year-olds? Whoever wants to come up about the 13-year, why you chose 13.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Rosanna Creighton, Executive Director of Citizens for a Drug-Free Oregon. Our technical assistants, they're not here today, but I do believe that that 13-year-old age range is part of the current statute on minors in possession, and we were putting in another part of that by allowing a diversion so that they could regain their driving privileges before a year. So that 13-year-old age minimum was already in there.
Senator Brockman, this is a wild guess, but I suppose you could have a situation where a person is just a hair short of 14 and gets some kind of alcohol offense and isn't adjudicated until after they turn 14, which would take them into their 15th year when you're eligible for a, I forget what they call them, learner's permit. So perhaps that's part of the rationale.
Well, it's fine with me.
I think that's the problem where we are.
I'm sure they're out
comments.
There.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
When they had a hearing on this before, I noted in line 7 that it technically this minor would have to be convicted of any offense for all of this to apply, and there isn't a conviction of a minor. It's a determination, and I wondered then and I wonder now if we shouldn't correct that.
Yes, please. Come, if you give us your name, please, for the record.
I'm Lois Dunham, Legislative Assistant to Senator Phillips. And I spoke with Joan Robinson today and asked her about that specifically. And in Section 1, it says conviction or if the person is determined by the juvenile court to have committed. Apparently, 17, 16-year-olds can be actually convicted of the crimes that are under, that are mentioned in this section. So it has to be in there convicted and determined by the court to have committed. So it covers both.
Thank you for your comments. Anything else?
I'm still troubled by, and maybe I haven't got this whole thing sorted out, but if a child is picked up for smoking a joint, not driving, but for smoking a joint, does this all follow then, that that child is then eligible for diversion and loses driving privileges even though the offense had nothing whatever to do with driving?
That's true.
And that's the point.
And that is existing law.
Do they do it? Is it?
What?
The senator's correct.
That's right. None of all of us believed that it was actually do what it said it was going to do. And I'm not sure how much they actually use it now.
But it is there. This allows conversion pieces for one of the other ones, too.
The pleasure of the committee on this, we do have a enough of a fiscal impact that it's got to go to Ways and Means eventually here. We're looking at $600,000+, even if we get it corrected. But I think it's...
Madam Chair, I'm going to move the -2 amendments.
Okay. Senator Hill has moved the -2 amendments.
Madam Chair, I guess I would also move the amendments identified as amendments to SB 977 and requests of Senator Phillips 53089. Or do you want to take
yes.
it separately?
Madam I'm Chair, happy. I think they ought to go. I think we can go together. That's the best information that we're going to get on the numbers. I think I'm not interested in second guessing the numbers given that. Are there any objections to Senator Hill's moving 977-2 and the Phillips amendments dated 53089? Hearing none, so ordered. Chase?
Madam Chair, then move Senate Bill 977 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee for that recommendation.
Okay. Jack, further comments on that?
No.
Okay, Senator Hill has moved Senate Bill 977 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Kiska. Brennan.
Aye.
Brockman.
Aye.
Benzie.
Aye.
Hill.
Aye.
Dumaker.
Aye.
Springer.
Aye.
Oh.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay. Senate Bill 2470, House Bill 2470 relating to sentencing. This bill has had hearing before.
This is the bill at the request of the Department of Justice having to deal with when a person can refuse the imposition of probation. There are some amendments as well as the letter from Judge Joseph, and I'll pass those out. I know we have Stevie Remington here from the ACLU, and Gail Pinnis here from the District Attorneys Association as well. And we have amendments that were discussed briefly last time from the State Court Administrator.
Okay.